Hi, everybody. Welcome back to WFAN's Baseball Insiders Podcast for Thursday, November 18th. I'm Sweeney Murdy, joined by Ed Coleman, as we combine for me and Eddie C and get you up to date on everything that's happening with the Mets and the Yankees. Eddie, let's start with the Mets, because I think we're finally in decision-making phase to push everything else forward after a number of people, you know, took their name out of the equation, and a number of people were just not fits for various reasons. The Mets seem to have landed on Billy Epler as their new general manager, so they can start moving forward here. What'd you make of the process and the eventual hire?
Well, the process was certainly a confusing one, to say the least, and I'm sure it was confusing for the Mets and Sandy Alderson and anybody else that was involved, I guess Steve Cohen as well. But I guess you get to the end result, and the end result I think is a good one, because you've hired a guy who's very familiar with New York, is not going to be afraid of the circumstances that this city can thrust upon a general manager of a baseball team. And I think Billy Epler is a very good hire, considering where they were or where they seem to be over the last couple of weeks. This was a job that nobody really seemed to want because of various circumstances, whether it be New York City, whether it be Steve Cohen, or whether it be the situation that, you know, you may have kind of an interim job until somebody like a David Stearns comes aboard as the president of baseball ops. But apparently Billy Epler and David Stearns are pretty good friends anyway. So if that comes about, it'll work out. It certainly was a convoluted way to get to where you wanted to be, and it took way too long and much too long, I think. And it obviously, I think, hurt the Mets in some way, shape, or form. We can talk about Syndergaard in just a little bit, but part of the fact that there was no infrastructure there, you know, I think played a role in that decision as well.
And Billy's got a good reputation throughout the game. Now, there's certainly some holes to poke in things that happened in Anaheim with the Angels. They didn't have a winning record under him. They had, obviously, they had Mike Trout for every one of those years, except for this past year. Shohei Ohtani was on board with Turk for a couple of years, then Blossom this year. So they had some talent, but they missed on a lot of pitching. They had some big contracts like Albert Pujols weighing them down for periods of time. And they had some odd decisions they had to make because of the payroll structure there. So it wasn't a success story in Anaheim, but Billy still has a pretty good reputation throughout from his time with the Yankees and from just the people that he's dealt with. So he's walking in a situation now where there's an imperfect roster in place, but there's obviously some talent on this team and a chance to move it forward here pretty quickly when you've already locked up Lindor going forward and you have some decisions to make here. The first decision you have to make here is with manager, I would think, and there are a number of names already being thrown out there as possibilities.
Yeah, there are. Buck Showalter's name has been front and center, I think, on a lot of people's ballots. Let's put it that way. Billy obviously has ties to Buck. I don't know if Buck has publicly campaigned for it, but I'm sure he'd like to manage again. I think he'd be an excellent choice. You know, we've seen guys from his era, if you will, Dusty Baker, Tony La Russa, obviously have success. There's a lot of thought about new school, old school, you know, with the analytics being so prevalent in today's game. You know, can you have an older manager or a manager that's embedded more in the old school have success? Well, I think you can. It, you know, it depends how open that you are to it, and I'm sure Buck is. Buck's pretty open to anything in baseball. He's a very, very sharp mind, and I'm not just concentrating on him, but there are other guys out there as well. But I think Buck's name has been, you know, front and center, first and foremost. So I believe he'll probably get an interview at some point in time with Billy. But I think getting a manager in place, obviously, will be a big key. The other thing that I think is key, and you hit upon it too, Sweeney, is pitching. You know, he never got that together in Anaheim. It was always a problem out there because, you know, you looked at the Angel lineup and you said, well, that's a pretty good team, but, you know, how far can the pitching carry you? Well, they never did. It never came together. And the Mets have a pitching problem right now. You know, Jacob DeGrom, who is the anchor of this staff and would be the anchor of a lot of staffs in baseball, you know, is still coming back from injury. Now, I think everyone assumes that he's going to be okay, but keep this in mind as well, too. If things don't exactly pan out here and pan out to his liking, he can opt out after this current season. So there's no guarantee that Jacob DeGrom is going to be here beyond. He loves New York just like Noah Syndergaard loved New York. Yeah. But Noah Syndergaard is now on the other coast, for reasons he kind of explained, and I think maybe self-explanatory too. But nonetheless, I think that's as big a key for Billy as the manager is to me, is to get this pitching staff in order and make sure that you have enough guys to carry through behind Jacob DeGrom, a healthy Jacob DeGrom, to get you through a major league season.
The Syndergaard decision seemed there's a lot going into that, and they offered him the qualifying offer. It felt like it was more to be able to get the pick compensation if he did go somewhere else, because it didn't feel like they were interested in going much beyond that $18.4 million as a qualifying offer. But I guess this is it feels like an unanswerable question, but maybe there's an answer here. If the Mets had even had a manager in place, would this, and you knew the manager and the pitching coach,
yeah,
do you think Noah Syndergaard, there was room for him to sign a deal back with the Mets?
I think it's possible. I do think that the Angels did a very good job in selling him to him. Perry Van Asten did a very good job coming, meeting him, having dinner with him, explaining everything they wanted to do. They took a gamble, but it's probably a gamble worth taking, at least in their minds anyway. But I think if things were more in place with the Mets, that Syndergaard might still be here. Keep in mind, Syndergaard always said how much he loved New York. He was thrilled to get the qualifying offer. And, when you consider a guy who's pitched two innings in the last 2 years, all of a sudden getting an $18.4 million payday after, he's been getting paid, and I think he made $9 million last year while he, basically pitched the two innings. That's still some pretty good money. He did always love New York, but I think, I think if the structure had been a little bit better and maybe somebody touched base with him a little more in the couple of weeks, after the World Series ended and before he decided to go out there, that things might have been a little bit different. There was a pitching coach in Jeremy Hefner. He was in place, no manager, though. And let's face it, the Mets have a lot of work to do in the structure of their organization from the general manager on down. So I do think that played into it a lot. And, Noah's one of those guys that's kind of goes with the wind a little bit. He figured that was the best thing for him at this point in time. Gives him a great chance to build up, have a great year, and then hit free agency again next year. So I guess the best of luck to him.
Syndergaard signed. Justin Verlander signed. He's got himself and he's another guy who's coming off an injury, got himself a pretty good deal. There's still some big name pitchers out on the board. Max Scherzer is obviously the biggest one, I would think. But, Marcus Stroman's an interesting position here, too, after having pitched the last year, a couple of years with the Mets here. So where do you see Stroman, and is Scherzer a possibility here?
Well, Scherzer has always said that, and he kind of rejected the Mets last year at the trading deadline. I think that was probably more out of loyalty to the Washington Nationals. Now that he's a Dodger and everything is opened up after the season is over, does it change his mind? Not sure. I guess money would change his mind. Max obviously wants to get the best deal he can and is probably not going to reject any club out of hand. But at the same time, I guess I feel it's still kind of a long shot that he would come to New York. But, if Scherzer wants to go out in style, one of the New York teams, being a member of them, either the Yankees or the Mets, might be a good way to do that. With Stroman, it's interesting. I'm sure Marcus has a figure in mind that he wants. I would not overpay for Marcus Stroman. I think, he was their most consistent pitcher last year, so you have to give him that. He had an outstanding year in that regard. I don't think, let's put it this way, I guess I wouldn't consider him a difference maker. I think he's a very solid guy that you can put in your rotation, and he will always, do his best to keep himself in shape. I wouldn't go overboard with a contract. If you can come to terms on a reasonable contract for both sides, I would sign up Marcus Stroman again. Yeah, but I'm not sure exactly what he's looking for. And I think it may be a bit beyond what I would pay anyway, in my estimation, for Stroman.
Eddie, the timing of these deals is kind of interesting. Both Syndergaard and Verlander had qualifying offer situations with a calendar they were dealing with. So that sped up the process for those two guys. But there's a CBA deadline approaching, and clearly there's money being spent. You know, Noah Syndergaard 21, Verlander 25, Jose Barrios got signed to a pretty big extension with the Blue Jays. There's a lot of money being thrown around, yet in about 12 days or so, everybody's going to be talking about whether or not they can agree on financial aspects of it. It seems kind of silly to be fighting about this when they're clearly throwing money around at this point, yet here we are in a situation where, you know, it's going to make these next 12 days interesting to see what happens.
It puts both sides, I think, in a very bad light if we do have a work stoppage coming on December the 2nd, and probably more so the players, because, you know, everyone talks about, well, look at the money that they're getting at this point in time. There's less focus, I think, on the owners or the teams that are giving the money to these players. But at the same time, I guess maybe the focus is always on the players or the people receiving the money. But I just think it puts both sides in bad light if you get to a point where you have an impasse here after what's happened to maybe not all the bright shining stars. Verlander obviously is, but there are other guys that, you look at Noah Syndergaard, pretty good money. He got a bump from the qualifying offer. You mentioned Barrios, who was a guy not a lot of people knew a heck of a lot about prior to the trading deadline last year, but all of a sudden he signed up for seven more years and a lot of money. There's a lot of money being thrown around out there. So I think you're right, Sweeney. It's, I don't know whether it puts more pressure on, getting something done here in the next couple of weeks. Hopefully it does, and there's something positive that comes, but I think it puts both sides in a terrible light if there's any kind of stoppage that comes up in a couple of weeks.
It feels like, it's at least, acknowledgement about where we are moving forward, even as a country too, because remember when past baseball season started, you're talking about percentage capacity of stadiums. Now, at the season ended, everyone was basically back at full capacity. You have teams who are beginning to sell tickets for next season at the beginning of the year and getting them out in time for holiday sales, which didn't happen last year. So there's, I think teams are feeling that we're moving toward a place where there is money to be had again early in the year. And that's a part of what we're doing. I guess that's a long way of saying teams are feeling that there is that this country is healthier, both, physically and financially at the start of next season. So that money is there for the taking.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. It's funny because, we've talked about this off and on when we've done shows, and it's almost, we're talking about money and the financial straits of the game and where everything sits for both sides moving forward, and can, both sides be happy. But what we really should be talking about beyond that is how to fix this game and how to make it better and make it more appealing to people who are dropping by the wayside. Let's face it. Let's be honest. People are coming back. They do love baseball. They love going to the ballpark and that. Are they coming back in record numbers? Well, that remains to be seen. Are they watching in record numbers? I think that remains to be seen as well, too. And, we always talk about the financial structure of the game and can it be healthy that way? But, can the game be healthy by itself? That's speeding up the game, getting more action in the game. Those are the things I think the baseball should be addressing more so than anything else. But you have to get by the financial structure and set that up for the next few years before you can address that. That's why, to me, it's that important to get this done and make sure it's done here in the next couple of weeks so that you can address some of the issues, like pitch clocks, et cetera, all the things that have come up over the last couple of years to make this game a better game and a more appealing game to fans.
I want to get back to manager for a second, Eddie, and just really more the timing aspect of it. I remember, when the Yankees hired Aaron Boone 4 years ago, they went through a lengthy process that didn't end until the first week in December. So they took a long time to get through this. I remember it was the first week in December because I was in the city doing, visiting Santa at Macy's when all this stuff started to break. So it's not unusual to it's not crippling to have it happen, deep into the off season, into the first week of December. But you're talking about this time period now with the CBA. You're talking about how long it already took you to get a general manager in place and the effect it had on Noah Syndergaard. Is it imperative for the Mets to go through this process fairly quickly. And you've heard, I mean, besides, we talked a little bit about Buck Showalter. Brad Ausmus is a guy that Billy Epler hired in Anaheim, so his name comes up. Joe Espada is a guy who has interviewed for several managerial positions. He's been with the Astros the last few years and has a history with Billy Epler. So as these, you know, is it imperative to get through some of these interviews quickly and get to a manager fairly soon?
Yeah, no, I think it's of the utmost importance. I think you hit it on the head. I think it's got to be Billy's, you know, first order of business, and I'm sure he has probably touched base with some of the names that you've mentioned already. He's very he's been tight with Ausmus. Of course, he hired him out there. Espada is another name that you mentioned. We've talked about Buck before, but and there are other guys too that I'm sure he wants to talk to. But I think it's imperative that you have a structure in place and try to get a coaching staff in place as well. Because there are many other issues that you have to address. You know, Michael Conforto is a free agent. Is he you going to extend an offer to him? Is he going to come back? Is he going to go elsewhere? How does your outfield set up if there is no Conforto out there? What do you do about third base? Robinson Cano is coming back. All right. What are you going to do there? Is there a DH?
Right.
how does that all work? I mean, there's a myriad of questions for Billy Epler. And, you know, listen, he's got a full plate. So he's got to hit the ground running, but you're right. Yeah. I mean, I do think that, you know, that's to get your structure in place and your order, as far as your everyday, you know, kind of, goings on with the ball club. And a manager is very important in that, because he's the guy, he's going to be the point man for you.
The man who used to be the manager for the Mets is now going to wear a Yankee uniform. Luis Rojas was announced this week as third base coach for the Yankees on Aaron Boone's staff. They had a mutual friendship, you know, over the last couple of years, seeing each other at Subway Series games. But you know, Rojas had mentioned when he spoke to us a couple of days ago that Aaron Boone was the first person who reached out to him when he got hired as the Mets manager, kind of welcomed him into the job. And I find it kind of funny that these are two guys who are steeped in generational baseball, you know, with Rojas with the Alou family and Boone with his family. It's an interesting pairing, having Rojas join the Yankees and having, you know, and having another major league manager, a guy with major league managing experience on the staff, which Aaron Boone did not have over the course of his first 4 years.
Luis Rojas is one of the finest people that I've ever met, honestly. An easy to talk to guy. I've known him for a long time in the Met organization when he was a minor league manager. And of course, he was on the staff as kind of a liaison with the analytics moving in to baseball so much between the players and the front office before he became manager. Anybody you talk to on the minor league level who had him as a manager loved him. And it's hard not to love Luis Rojas. It's a great opportunity for him. I don't think Aaron Boone is threatened at all by having a former manager for a couple of years, a guy that he went toe-to-toe with in the Subway Series. But it's also it's a great situation for Luis Rojas, because it keeps him very visible. He's the third base coach of the New York Yankees. I think he will be a good manager in baseball. Obviously, those opportunities will come up after each season, I'm assuming, and he can interview for those jobs. And I think the Yankees would be, you know, more than happy to, you know, see him interview and you know, move himself forward and get back to where he probably wants to be. But I think he's going to be a great addition to the Yankees organization. And I think any organization that has Luis Rojas in it is a better organization. That's how highly I think of him.
He's also going to be the outfield instructor, so that helps fill part of the role that Reggie Willits left. Reggie Willits left professional baseball to go work in college closer to his home in Oklahoma. And so that helps fill part of that. The Yankees are still looking for a first base coach and hitting coaches. The Marlins hired Marcus Thames as their hitting coach. So he's not out of work long, landed on his feet well, I think, as we all pretty much expected. Marcus has a very good reputation in this game as well. As the Yankees move on to other business, Eddie, it's free agent season, it's trade season, and I don't know how it's going to be affected by this December 1st or 2nd deadline, but they've got some roster things to, you know, they've got roster decisions about who to protect. So moving guys off the 40-man roster in trades is probably a pretty something that's pretty significant to happen quickly here. And perhaps that sees itself play out as the Yankees pursue Matt Olson, as the A's have signaled that, you know, they're willing to let some of these guys go. Olson would be a pretty good fit here. better than I think Matt Chapman, who's also on the block. And, you know, Chapman's a guy that you think about maybe for the Mets. But the A's are open for business. I think Matt Olson makes a lot of sense here and potentially is in play for the Yankees as they look to fill the spot, which Luke Voit is still on the roster, but they've made it known that he's available in a trade. And Anthony Rizzo is a free agent after spending a couple of months here with the Yankees this season.
Well, I think your owner made it pretty clear that there'll probably be a free agent shortstop coming your way. Yeah. You know, who that is, we don't know, but maybe he gave some hints in that regard. But, you know, the names that are being bandied about, either one of them, I guess, and probably Seager and Correa have been the two most prevalent. But nonetheless, I think that's a good way to go. And you can speak to this probably a little bit better. The balance of the lineup, that's always been a question with the Yankees. And, you know, you mentioned Olson. That's a good place to start, obviously. But I think getting a balance in that lineup for the Yankees is probably something that would make Aaron Boone very happy and probably make you a much better baseball team, too.
Olson and let's say Seager, you know, adding left-handed bat really impacts the balance of a lineup like that. If Aaron Hicks comes back healthy as a switch hitter, I still think they need to address center field, not just count on Hicks being the starting center fielder on opening day after missing almost all this past season. And Starling Marte is available, a guy that they've eyed up. He bats from the right side. But even if, you know, just let's say Olson and Seager, they dramatically impact the balance of that lineup. And, you know, Brian Cashman has been asked about that a few times, and, you know, it hasn't been by design that they've been all right-handed. It's just that, you know, you look at a player like DJ LeMahieu or Gio Urshela, and you have them available, and they are good players, and they happen to be right-handed. And that impacts, you know, you can't necessarily, you know, what they didn't want to do is take a lesser player than DJ LeMahieu simply because he batted left-handed as opposed to right-handed. Well, now you're in a situation where you have some left-handed bats available and can make you better. And here's the thing that kind of dropped into my head, Eddie, and I'm curious what you think about this. You know, a lot of, you know, you have 19 meetings a year against the Tampa Bay Rays, who have a lot of these right-handed relievers they can throw at you. And it impacts the way your season goes. And even in a playoff series, as we saw against the Rays as well. The other sport analogies that I kind of come up with here, you know, it's not unusual in other sports to see a team built specifically for a matchup against another opponent. And when I think about this, you would remember this very well. The Pistons built themselves to beat the Celtics in the '80s. And the Bulls built themselves to beat the Pistons. They went for a specific matchup that they knew was coming down the road. And as the Yankees have seen themselves beaten by the Tampa Bay Rays in the playoffs and the regular season because of this righty-righty matchup, it makes some sense to build yourself specifically for this matchup. And it's not just looking ahead to the postseason because, as I mentioned, 19 times a year you're matching up against a Rays team that goes to its bullpen early and often. So you have the ability to control that part of a matchup. And even in football, I remember seeing it. You know, remember in the '90s when the Cowboys and 49ers would almost take turns building roster moves to match up against each other. You know, Deion Sanders is going to land somewhere specifically for a matchup against one of those teams. It's harder to do in baseball, but I feel like that's something that you have to address now and have the ability to get a few more left-handed bats in there, impact left-handed bats, not just left-handed bats, and better build your balance for a specific matchup, whether it's against Tampa Bay or against Boston in your own division. You got to be able to navigate through the East and through that division, and a better balanced lineup helps you do that.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. You know, you bring it struck a memory with me because I remember Lambeer and Mahorn, McFilthy and McNasty, as Johnny Most used to describe the two of them. But that you're absolutely right. It was a matchup that they got together to defeat the more physical Celtics at the time. But you know, it's a great point. You do have to get through your division to get yourself to the playoffs. Tampa Bay has blunted them how many times? Numerous times, and has caused all kinds of havoc, you know, within the division. So, yeah, no, I think it's an excellent point. I think you're right. You can draw from those analogies, but it does make an awful lot of sense that you've got to get through your own division to get yourself to the playoffs and then worry about things later. But it's always good to strike a balance. And I think that's one thing that's been a little bit out of whack with the Yankees. Maybe not by design. It just happens that way. And like you mentioned with LeMay, you're not going to turn down DJ LeMay just because he's a right-handed hitter. He's a terrific player. Okay. But when you have a chance to balance things out, you do, obviously, now when you've made a decision about getting, say, a shortstop and, moving somebody else, you've got to do that. And I think that's it's a great opportunity for him.
I wonder where, you have some perspective on this, too, because of where the Mets just came from. The Yankees have two very highly rated shortstops in their system who are probably within the next 2 years going to be able to touch the majors. And it's Anthony Volpe and Oswald Peraza. The track that these guys appear to be on by 2023, they are major league caliber players and maybe sooner. The Mets were in a situation where they traded for Francisco Lindor and got rid of a couple of quality young shortstop prospects to be able to do that. And they made that decision going forward here. How hard is that, do you think, for a team to say, look, you've got guys who you think will be major league quality players, but you have to take a chance on a known at a high price level because you're at a certain point with the rest of your roster to have to push forward for more of a known quantity. Now, Francisco Lindor didn't live up to expectations first year, but you obviously see the talent and the potential there. And you, what you hope is a brighter future for the next several years here. What did you make of the decision the Mets had to make, given what they had to give up and what they had in their system as a shortstop at shortstop?
Yeah, it's an interesting problem, and I think it's a problem that every team has at some point in time. The Mets have Ronnie Mauricio, who they love. And is probably, he's a shortstop. He's a guy that's pretty close to the majors as well. But I think he's also going to be playing an awful lot of second base as well, because I think Lindor is here. You're going to be able to switch him over there. They also have another guy named Brett Beatty, who is going to be a terrific player and may solve their third base problem, maybe not next year, but it's going to solve their third base problem eventually. But I think every team has to run across that, and you have to think about being versatile and try to get as many versatile players as you can. That's why Chris Bryant, to me, is such a gem that's out there in the free agent market this year. He's a guy that can play not only the infield, but all the outfield positions as well. And, he's probably a better corner guy, but, he's played some center field too. So, having a guy like that in your lineup, to me, is just invaluable. But I think it's a decision that every team has to make. And it is a difficult one because you have to, first go through the process of, can this guy make the switch and will he be the same kind of player when he does that? I think you have to look at the overall, offensive capabilities of somebody and then figure out whether defensively he can handle that position switch. But I think it's it's obviously something that I think every club goes through, but it's a very important decision too that you have to make ahead of time to make sure there's room for these people as they come along.
Yeah, and listen, the Yankees are, I have not heard Yankees personnel, or even people, really mostly Yankees personnel, but there are people around the game who really like Anthony Volpe too. But I haven't heard people talk about a prospect in this organization in a long time, the way they talk about Anthony Volpe, everything he can bring from a physical game standpoint, but from the character standpoint that you always value so highly when you're talking about players coming up. That's something that I haven't heard people talk about another Yankees prospect the way they talk about Volpe. So I'd be hard pressed to believe they're going to give up on him. And it's not even so matter much of blocking him, understanding positional flexibility. I think that's a conversation that if you're going to go after Corey Seager or Carlos Correa, I think those are conversations you have to have right out of the gate, saying, listen, we see at some point you moving to third base. We see at some point you having to be part of this because we have a lot of talent, and doesn't mean it's happening tomorrow, but we want to have this conversation now before we sign you to a 7 or 8 or 10 year deal and give you a lot of money. Those are guys I don't think, we talk about how the pitchers have been moving and might move quickly. I don't think those guys are moving anytime soon before we figure out the CBA. That's just the way I kind of see it right now. I don't know if you feel different.
Yeah, no, I kind of feel that way too. I don't know who the first guy is going to be to drop in the shortstop market. There are obviously several guys out there. It's interesting to me with Baez, because Baez impressed a lot of people in the Mets organization. There's a lot to like, and there's a lot to dislike about Javier Baez. He did make an effort to become more amenable to being a more patient hitter. But is that something that goes away after he signs a 5 or 6 year deal? I don't know. That's a great question, because he's very much an instinctual player, but he's very much a lightning rod. You know, I watched Javier Baez, blow up games for the Mets, but I also saw him win games all by himself. And I know Sandy Alderson, he may not be making the ultimate decision now that Billy Epler is here, but Javier Baez is an intriguing guy to me. And where does he fit into the equation for the Mets? They don't need a shortstop, but he can play second base. So that whole market with Correa and Sager and Story, it's interesting. But I think it might be slow. But when the first one drops, I think the rest will drop fairly quickly, I think.
Marcus Semien part of that mix too,
and yeah, that's exactly. Another
interesting name. Listen, we've gone on a little bit longer than we normally do, mostly because it's been a little while since we spoke, and there's been a lot of things happening. So I hope people appreciate that we spent a little bit extra time here. The next ones will be shorter because hopefully we'll have more things to talk about and do a little bit more often over the course of the winter and get people going. Eddie, it's always great to I get to see you. It's always great to hear you, and thanks for jumping on here. And I will wish you a happy Thanksgiving and hope to talk to you again very soon.
And I hope that we don't have a work stoppage about a week after Thanksgiving or so. But Sweeney, always good to talk to you. Thanks, man.
That'll be fun. He's Ed Coleman. I'm Sweeney Murdy. This is WFAN's Baseball Insiders. Subscribe, review, and all that jazz. Until next time, thanks for listening.